Morning, council. Lucky enough to get the last slot on the calendar today. The next case on our calendar is A23-0010, State of Minnesota versus Christopher Lee Manska. You will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are webcasting the oral argument today. We are also making an audio recording. The audio recording will be available tomorrow sometime, usually within 24 hours of the oral argument, but no other recordings are permitted of the oral argument. So to anyone that may be watching on Zoom today, no recordings are permitted. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. If you can introduce yourself and the party you represent, we would appreciate it.
Good morning. My name is Andrew Nelson. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Christopher Manska. Mr. Manska raises two issues in this appeal, but this morning I'd like to focus on the first, which is whether the district court abused its discretion by refusing to compel discovery of evidence that was necessary to determine whether a police officer had deleted a critical portion of the video of Mr. Manska's traffic stop. A district court abuses its discretion in two situations. First, when it misapplies the law, and second, when its decision is contrary to the facts in the record. Here, both situations are present. First, the district court misapplied the law because it required Mr. Manska to meet a standard far higher than what is required under Rule 901. That rule requires that the district court may compel disclosure of any relevant evidence in the state's possession or control, and here's the important part, provided that the defendant makes a showing that the information may relate to his guilt or innocence. Mr. Manska satisfied that standard. In this case, Mr. Manska sought the district court to compel disclosure of the evidence audit trail for the Axon dash camera. In support of that request, Mr. Manska offered not only 12 handwritten motions, but also 4 exhibits. The first exhibit was a February 11th, 2021 email from Brian Childs, who is the senior investigations engineer at Axon, the company that manufactures the dash cameras at issue. In that email, Mr. Childs explained that the police department is the only agency with access to that video. He explained that the video cannot be modified on the camera, but once it's uploaded to the system, it can be deleted. He explained that if you want to verify whether the video uploaded and the video turned over to you in discovery are the same video, you need to compare the audit trail on both videos. In addition to that email, Mr. Manska also submitted 2 separate text exchanges with Mr. Childs and an 8-page printout from Axon's website. Those exhibits explained what an audit trail is, how to access it, how to read it. It gave the district court all of the information it needed to compel disclosure under this rule. Rather than apply Rule 901 as it's written in the rule, the district court applied its own standard and required Mr. Manska to prove that the video itself was not unauthentic in order to get access to the evidence he needed to prove that it was not authentic.
Can I ask you on that point, and perhaps it was a bit inartful wording the judge used, but in order to get to the may relate to guilt or innocence, doesn't there does have to be a predicate in this case, some level of credible allegation that indeed it's not authentic, other than just saying it's not, right? So what tangibly from the record did the court ignore, as a matter of fact, that would show that there was an inaccuracy?
So I have 2 responses, Your Honor. The first is, when you look at the language of the rule, it's the court may compel disclosure of any information that may relate to your guilt or your innocence. So guilt is in there as well. So a defendant doesn't even have to show that the information might be helpful. It could be hurtful, and the defendant's still entitled to it under this rule.
In counsel, in Under Dahl, though, I think the Supreme Court clarified that to make that showing, a defendant must make some plausible showing that the information sought would be both material and favorable to the defense.
That's correct.
So back to Judge Sleater's question, I'm not clear how that standard was met here.
So here's the reason why it would be favorable. If Mr. Manska was given the audit trail, and after reviewing the audit trail, comparing the audit trail on the original video with the audit trail that was of the video disclosed to him in discovery, and let's say the two are the exact same, well, then it relates to his guilt because it shows that this claim doesn't have merit. If instead he reviews the two audit trails and there is a difference, then it contradicts the officer's claim that the officer did not delete any video and that the entire video was disclosed.
Is it your view that in every case a defendant is entitled to request the audit trail of a dash cam video under Rule 9.01?
This is very similar to the Under Dahl line of cases. Not every defendant who just requests it is entitled to it, but defendants who offer some exhibits, some testimony showing that it could be relevant to their case, they are entitled to it.
And I think the district court found that this information didn't meet that standard, and in fact that the Chiles email, you know, was contrary to the necessary showing because it said that the officer couldn't modify or edit the video while it's being taken, and it can be deleted, but only deleted. In other words, it can't be modified.
So it is important to read the entire email, and I think the district court's analysis essentially stopped short of finishing this paragraph. What Mr. Chiles is explaining is on the camera, so the dash camera that's installed in the car, you cannot modify, you cannot edit, you cannot delete, you cannot do anything on the camera. But once it's uploaded to the system, to Axon Evidence or evidence.com, then it can be deleted. And the context of this email...
Well, it says deleted, it doesn't say modified. And it, as I read that, that's suggesting deleting means wiping out.
So when you read this email and you read the text messages, I think it contradicts an idea that he's saying you can only delete the entire thing.
Okay.
Because the officer, or Mr. Chiles, wouldn't have explained to Mr. Manska that it's, you know, worth comparing these two things if all it's going to show is that the entire video is deleted. I think these exchanges explain that there is a possibility the videos can be different, and not just in the sense that one exists and one has been completely deleted. It would be very obvious to Mr. Manska if the video he received was nothing.
So all that says is that you can confirm that the video is authentic. But, I mean, how does that show that there's some basis to suspect that this video is not authentic?
So, again,
I mean, going back to Judge Sleater's question.
So again, my response is there is no requirement under this rule that you show the video is not authentic. And what I would point this court to is to look at Under Dahl in the cases. I'm sorry.
But how does a judge then make the finding that it may affect guilt or innocence unless there's some predicate level? Otherwise, any discovery of anything, I want it, I get it. And we know that's not the case. So doesn't it would have to be a tangible or credible maybe prima facie showing that, in fact, this is inauthentic. And then once you can make that level, then a judge has something upon which to say it may. So that's why the Under Dahl case, the expert there, went into great detail of the source code and how it was used, that sort of thing. There seemed to be a distinction between that and the Brunner case because there was nothing. And I realize your point being, well, we got Mr. Chiles, but as Judge Cochran pointed out, it's a little hard to really make heads or tail. Like, actually, how does that show it may? It just shows there's a possibility of doing something to it. But what in this case was presented to the judge to show it may affect his guilt or innocence?
So I think Under Dahl is a good use of our time in this argument. So in Under Dahl was the defendant who didn't offer anything. Brunner was the defendant who offered, I believe it was 9 exhibits and some testimony in support of his motion. What I want to be very clear about is Brunner did not argue that the source code in his case was inaccurate or that there was a problem with his source code. He offered testimony showing that if he can review the source code, he may find issues that could be relevant to his case. Essentially, he needed to review this to determine if the thing was functioning accurately. And that's what Mr. Manska was asking for here. He was asking to see the audit trail to see if this video was functioning accurately. And I would point this court to, there's an unpublished case. It's not cited in my brief. I believe it's pronounced Grancy. The site is 2010 Westlaw 445-1243. And the reason I mention that case is in that case, the court reversed, and they held the defendant satisfied 901 by offering expert statements that explained what conditions could cause an intoxilizer to achieve an inaccurate result. And this court described Rule 901 as a very low showing. So Mr. Manska didn't have to show that the video was modified. He had to show that if he...
I agree with that, and if I said that earlier, I misspoke. But, you know, I think Underdahl makes clear that the showing is... The Underdahl showing, in that case, the showing was, you know, there was an expert witness. This email is significantly different than the showing that was made in the Underdahl case. So how is this email enough to get him over the hurdle, or the language in Underdahl?
Your Honor, can I ask, why do you believe it's different than the expert statement in Underdahl?
Because I think I'd have to pull up the Underdahl case, but I believe in Underdahl, the expert provided more detail about the coding and how it would support the case versus here. I mean, this statement about the hash copy and the SH2 hash of the copy you have versus the SH2 hash on the evidence audit trail would prove whether the copy is identical to the original. I mean, that sort of seems to be a self-fulfilling statement. And maybe I'm not appreciating the significance of that, but I'm not sure how that shows that there's a basis to believe that this evidence meets the standard in Underdahl that it would be material and favorable to the defense.
When we talk about material and materiality and favorability, if Mr. Manskin, again, it's difficult for us to show prejudice. In a case like Sturdivant, which is another unpublished case, what this court did in a discovery case is they found there was an inaccurate interpretation of the discovery rules, and they remanded for the district court to determine prejudice. It is difficult in this case to show any kind of prejudice until we know what the audit trails would show. But assuming what Mr. Manska has been arguing this entire time, that the videos are different, that the audit trails are different, then it is material to his case, because then it shows that an officer removed content from a video of his stop.
And the only basis that we have in the record before us for him suggesting the videos are different was his belief that he didn't cross the fog line and that the video didn't go far back enough in time to show what he did or didn't do when he was driving.
That's correct. The officer testified that he believed the swerve happened a minute or 2 minutes before he started recording. So Mr. Manska believes that portion was recorded. The officer testified that it wasn't.
If you look at the video and the timing, the video goes on about 30 seconds before the lights go on.
That's correct.
Which is consistent with the timing the officer testified to in terms of automatic activation.
At first glance, it seems consistent, but it's actually inconsistent in two ways. So the officer testified that every Axon dash cam video for their department begins with 30 seconds of silent video. We are missing that in this case. So we are missing at least 30 seconds according
to me. That argument wasn't made to the district court.
Your Honor, that's a fact in the record, not an argument we're raising on appeal. We are raising the same arguments on appeal that were raised below.
Right, but you do argue that supports the idea that there's some reason to doubt or some need to compare the hash on the recordings.
Yes, that's correct. It's a fact that was admitted into evidence that contradicts the court's conclusions.
But there wasn't any discussion of that, the audio being on versus off, on that video before the district court in my review of the transcript.
That's correct. And there is no requirement under forfeiture doctrine that had to be done. Forfeiture only applies to arguments. This is a fact in the record that shows the court abused its discretion. And I think it may be smart for the last 2 minutes to jump into that argument. So as I said before, a court abuses its discretion when its decision is contrary to the law or contrary to the facts in the record. Here, even assuming that the court's finding that he didn't offer any evidence to show this video is unauthentic, even assuming that that's the correct legal analysis, it is contradicted by the record the district court had before it when it made this decision. The district court had a copy of the dash cam video. It also had the officer's sworn testimony during the contested omnibus hearing. And the video and the officer's testimony do not line up. That was information the court had at the time it made its decision. And even though the video shows that the video may not be authentic, the court found that Mr. Manska hadn't met his burden. And so that there is an abuse of discretion based on the facts in the record. And I know we discussed this a little bit, Judge Cochran, but when the state argues forfeiture here, forfeiture applies to arguments that were raised on appeal that weren't raised below. It's there to prevent a defendant from raising things for the first time on appeal. The arguments Mr. Manska is raising in this appeal, the first argument, is that the court should have compelled disclosure. He argued that 12 times below. His second argument is that the officer lacked reasonable suspicion. He argued that he had a contested omnibus hearing on that, and the court issued an order on that. So Mr. Manska is not raising a new argument on this appeal. He's simply pointing to facts in the record that were before the court at the time the court made its decision. If this court doesn't have any other questions, I'll see you on rebuttal.
Great. Thank you very much. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready. There's a button, you're probably aware of that.
It's going to have to go way down. Can I move this?
Yep.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Lydia Villalva-Lijo, and I'm an assistant attorney general representing respondent in this appeal. Appellant made multiple motions that are related to Officer Savlinen's dash camera video. Mainly, appellant claimed that he did not have a complete or authentic version of the video and that Officer Savlinen had deleted or edited sections of the video. But appellant did not make a showing under Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 9.01, Subdivision 2.3, that he was entitled to the dash cam video audit trail because he failed to explain how obtaining the audit trail could relate to his defense. Mr. Manska was focused in all of his motions in asserting and trying to point out the officer's conduct, and he failed to discuss or address how it related to his own guilt or innocence. And even if appellant had explained...
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't he argue that, this could show that part of the video that he was provided was not the complete video, and that would support his view that that he didn't cross the fog line and that the officer misstated... when the officer said he crossed based the stop on crossing the fog line, that wasn't supported by the record, or that isn't there. It would support, I'm not articulating this very well, sorry. But anyway, doesn't it relate to his defense that there wasn't reasonable articulable suspicion to pull him over because he didn't cross the fog line, and it would support his view that the video was not complete?
Well, it broadly relates to that. But even if appellant had explained clearly how obtaining the dash cam audit trail would have or could have related to his guilt or innocence of the charged offenses, it would not have made a difference to the verdict for two reasons. First, Officer Savlinen's decision to stop appellant had nothing to do with the dash cam video. The decision was based on the officer's personal observation that appellant had driven across the fog line twice while driving south on US 169, late at night on September 2nd, 2020, and that it was that observation that provides the basis for the stop.
And well, second, go ahead.
The ties together, doesn't it? Because obviously, if it's discovered and if the audit trail shows there's been an editing of the dash cam video, then it would go to the issue of whether he was credible in saying that he drove over the line, and that's tied to the fact that neither other passenger observed it either that were in the vehicle. So you would have to get to that point before you would make that judgment, I assume.
No, that's a you pointed out, Judge Sleater, that's a credibility determination. That's not necessarily or does not clearly go to guilt or innocence of the charged offenses. But I'd also like to answer your question or respond to your point in this way. Second, even if there was more dash cam video, it would not necessarily relate to appellant's guilt or innocence, and here's why. The dash camera video that was received as evidence at the January 2022 suppression hearing shows that the vehicle appellant was driving was beyond the reach of the squad car's headlights. In other words, the vehicle that Mr. Manska was driving was not always illuminated by the squad car's headlights, which goes to what is visible on the video. It was also nighttime. This occurred in a rural area. The squad's windshield wipers are activated, which suggests that there is some either current precipitation or there recently had been some precipitation. So under these circumstances, it is possible that even if there was more dash cam video, the tires crossing the fog line may not have even been visible on that video. So appellant's request for the audit trail focused on claiming that the officer had purposely deleted or tampered with the dash cam video, but he did not show how that related to his guilt or innocence of the DWI, driving after cancellation, test refusal, and other charges. Without this connection, appellant's request was a fishing expedition that's not permitted by the discovery rules. And if one looks at the arc of motions that were submitted by Mr. Manska, describing it as a fishing expedition is not that harsh of a description. Mr. Manska begins by requesting the SD cards. The motions constantly change as to what is being sought. As we reach the end of the motions, Mr. Manska is requesting the audit trail, and he's claiming that not only the dash cam video was altered, but that the body cam video was altered because he recalls the officer saying, "Mr. Manska, you crossed the center line," but the body cam reflects that Officer Savlinen pointed out to Mr. Manska that he had crossed the fog line twice. So it was a constant change in motion that was occurring here. The district court did her best to respond to each of those motions in detail. She held two hearings, issued two orders. The entire record of this issue reflects that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Manska's request for the audit trail information. Are there any additional questions?
Well, can we talk about the Underdahl case and can you respond to appellant's argument that the showing here is similar to the showing that was made in, I believe, Brunner was the individual who made the showing, that the showing here was similar to that with Brunner in terms of the source code there and a comparison of the hashtags here?
Not to be disrespectful or flip, but they're not even close. Brunner presented written testimony by a computer science expert to the court in addition to the multiple exhibits. And what was submitted here to the court was an email exchange. It was not given under oath. It wasn't in the form of an affidavit. There was no opportunity to, it's an email. It's fine for what it was, but it doesn't answer a lot of the questions, and it clearly doesn't go to the issue of, it may have explained and discussed how to use the audit trail or how to identify that there was a difference in videos, but it does not address, that email does not address and go to the larger issue of how it related to guilt or innocence.
Would you agree, counsel, I'm getting back to the guilt or innocence, that, you know, but for driving over the fog line, there's no stop, or it would be suppressed, any evidence submitted after that. If the judge had found that there was a lack of articulable suspicion, reasonable suspicion to stop, and that could be based on a credibility finding, then there would be a dismissal of all charges.
I would agree that, again, not to be difficult, Your Honor, you're correct that if the district court had somehow, if this stop was tossed for lack of reasonable articulable suspicion, that goes to the validity of the stop. And I don't mean to parse hairs here or split hairs, but it doesn't go to guilt or innocence. The actual guilt or innocence here was whether he was under driving while impaired, driving after cancellation. Those are the charges that he went to trial on. He was not charged with violating a traffic lane, the traffic
right.
lane statute
but,
that's cited.
And I'm not sure I see that distinction in Brunner, because obviously the source code would reveal whether the test was accurate or could reveal whether it was accurate, and if it's not accurate, then you're innocent. So I assume that's the context we're talking. So if something was revealed that to show that there had been a change to the video, that would certainly affect the district court's credibility finding regarding the officer's testimony that it crossed the fog line, could lead to a different result, which means everything's suppressed, which means he's innocent of everything.
I understand, Your Honor, and I'm not disagreeing with
okay.
you. Let me here's another way to think about it. So in Underdahl, what's at issue is the source code for the intoxilizer, because the intoxilizer produces breath test results that indicate whether a person either is or is not under the influence of alcohol for DWI purposes. What was at issue here is a little bit is different. So maybe I did not point it out as well as I should have, but even if you have an issue with the dash cam video, you still have the officer's observation and his testimony about what he observed that evening, which is separate from the dash cam video and does not have to be corroborated by that dash cam video. The officer's personal observation of a traffic violation is enough to support reasonable articulable suspicion for a stop.
But is that the basis the district court denied? And maybe I misunderstand. I thought it, and that's why I was focusing on the issue of there was no predicate information to the district court to believe it may lead to guilt or innocence, simply because he said he edited it and also didn't find the engineer enough information there. That seems a little different than what you're arguing today, is that under any scenario, it just would not lead to guilt or innocence.
Well,
there's nothing, in other words, from it that would lead to a guilt or innocence. That's a little different.
When I gave the example earlier about the, if there were more dash cam video that was available that showed what happened in the few minutes prior to the stop, the point of that description of what the video shows was to point out that it's one piece of evidence, but it may not have shown the fog line violation. So even if that was available, it would not necessarily have shown the fog line violation.
But it could have.
It could have. But also, it's not necessary to corroborate Officer Savlinen's testimony.
So you're arguing that we should interpret Rule 9.01 very narrowly to relate purely to guilt or innocence and not pretrial suppression motion, evidence that could relate to a pretrial suppression motion?
Well, I guess how I would place it is even more specific to this case, that Mr. Manska did not carry his burden to establish that obtaining the audit trail of the dash cam video related to his guilt or innocence. He submitted information to the court, a lot of information to the court about his own theory, about Officer Savlinen's conduct, but he failed, and this is a big difference between Mr. Manska and Mr. Bruner. Mr. Manska failed to connect how that related to his guilt or innocence. So he did not make a proper showing under the rule to establish that he was entitled to the audit trail. And again, as I tried to point out, if one looks at the arc of his motions and you see how they change and he's asking for different things, it seems to be a fishing expedition. I see that I'm just about out of time. Are there any further questions? I hope I've answered them all.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you very much. All right, counsel, for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
While I raise this back up, there's 3 points I'd like to make on rebuttal. The first is the officer testified here that he believes the swerve happened 2 minutes before the video starts. If we have 1 or 2 more minutes of video, and that video shows that Mr. Manska didn't swerve across the fog line, then the officer's testimony here, his credibility, goes down the toilet. If he says, I saw a swerve, and a video doesn't show a swerve, that isn't credible testimony. That's where we get that this impacts the case. The second point I want to make is in respondent's argument, she mentioned that she believes this case isn't even in the same ballpark as Brunner. I'm going to actually take a different position and say I think this is better than Brunner. Brunner had 9 exhibits. That's true. We have 4. But this isn't a game of who has the most exhibits, right? Mr. Manska could have submitted exhibits from 20 of his family members, and that would be worth almost nothing. What Mr. Manska submitted in this case is testimony in the form of an email, because Mr. Manska was self-represented and incarcerated. He submitted an email from the senior investigations engineer at Axon, the company that makes these video cameras. That is significantly better testimony than testimony from a computer science professional in Brunner who doesn't work with intoxilizers. This is a person, an engineer, in the company that makes the cameras.
But specifically, how did that information from Mr. Chow support this demand for the tape? It didn't seem to.
No, I disagree, Your Honor. So Mr. Childs explained that the only way you can tell if the video you received is actually authentic, the only way you can tell is by comparing the audit trail with the original and comparing that audit trail with the video that you received. So what Mr. Childs established is what this rule requires, us showing that the evidence, if you get it, could relate to your guilt or innocence. He established, just through this email, that if you get the audit trail, you could find out whether this video has been deleted. And that's enough under this standard.
Didn't he also say, though, that the officer had no capacity to delete or modify it?
On the camera, Your Honor, yes. But once it's uploaded, he said it can be deleted. And then he says, but a deletion will be logged into an audit trail. If you compare the 2 audit trails, you can find out if video has been deleted. So again, I would argue that this is actually better than Brunner because Mr. Manska offered a better witness than Brunner offered.
Mr. Nelson, Ms. Leho raises an intriguing point, and Judge Cochran asked about it too, the distinction. It obviously in the underdog, the source code cases, they were not going to a constitutional a seizure or stop issue, which we have here. And it kind of brings to my mind, we've had cases involving the exoneration statute where someone's found not guilty. That doesn't make you exonerate. You actually affirmatively show that you were innocent of it. Is there any case law that you've seen that would bring in the guilt or innocence, which will concede from a broad criminal standpoint, whatever the video shows wouldn't go to his guilt or innocence of test refusal and all the other crimes that occurred, but only goes to the constitutionality of the stop, arguably. Is there any case law that you've seen under that rule that applies it directly to our scenario here of a stop issue that from which the evidence would arise from?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case law either applying it that way or saying that it can't be applied my way. If Underdahl was the authority I was relying on, it might be different, but the authority I'm relying on is the rule. Underdahl just interprets the rule. And I think it's fair to say that in this case, if the officer had deleted video, and if Mr. Manska had gained the evidence he needed to be able to potentially prove that, this would relate to his guilt or innocence because the case would be thrown out. I take your point, but I don't believe there is a case directly on point.
And your point is the rule is not so restricted. We just look at the plain reading of the rule.
The rule is not that restrictive.
And obviously discoveries, you're entitled to it early on in the process.
Yes. Okay. And there's a reason why defense attorneys make these contested omnibus hearing suppression motions, because it relates to their client's guilt or innocence.
By the way, do you know, and I forgot to ask Ms. Leo, there was such a trouble with transcript in this case, it appears to be. Any idea why or what?
So there is an affidavit filed in the record. I asked the court reporter to file an affidavit explaining why. I can't give you the number for it. But I believe whoever was in charge of that hearing didn't hit the record button, and so there was no recording to transcribe the two important hearings in this case.
Thank you.
The last point I want to make is I do want to briefly touch on reasonable suspicion because I didn't get to touch on it before. Setting aside this issue with the video that I'm talking about, where I believe the transcript of the officer's testimony in the video shows that 30 seconds is missing, we still have really troubling facts aside from the video. Here we have three people in a squad car. We have a veteran police officer, we have a rookie cop, and we have a ride-along student. Essentially, the senior officer is training both of those people in the car. He's teaching, Your Honor, do you mind if I go for 30 more seconds?
Yes, that's fine.
So this officer is here to teach the other two people in the car. He spots a car with whiskey plates, suggesting that this driver at some point in the past has had a DWI. He stops the car. He doesn't tell anybody, including the officer that he's training, why he's stopping this car. He then approaches the car and arrests Mr. Manska on suspicion of DWI. One thing you can take from his testimony is he made a choice. Assuming that he didn't delete anything, he made a choice not to capture this on his dash camera. He chose to wait past the 30 seconds to hit the button. And by that choice, we don't have this driving infraction, this alleged driving infraction on video. So we have these video cameras for a reason, and the officer, at a minimum, chose not to use it in this case. I would ask this court to either remand and compel disclosure of the audit trail, or I'd ask this court to reverse based on reasonable suspicion and vacate Mr. Manska's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. We will look closely at the case, of course, and issue our opinion within the statutory time frame. That completes the oral calendar for today. We are now in recess to consider our non-oral calendar.
All rise.